Welcome back to Current State. A reminder that WKAR's Fall Donor Campaign launches here on 90.5 FM and AM 870 on Friday. Now, if you visit WKAR.org now and make a contribution, which you can do and which we encourage you to do, you'll automatically be entered to win a one-night stay and play. Stay and play, courtesy of Firekeepers Hotel and Casino in Battle Creek. We will announce the winner of that on October 14th during Current State. Again, WKAR.org to take care of your contribution or gift to WKAR, and we gratefully accept your support. Thank you for that. If you listen to NPR's Morning Edition program, you've been hearing from voters across America in their Divided States project. The project brings us the voices of voters across the country who've decided to vote for Democrat Hillary Clinton for president, as well as others who'll cast their vote for Republican nominee Donald Trump. They discuss the issues in the election, how their candidates have responded to those issues, and they've also talked about all of the negatives in the campaign. Here at Current State, we've been listening with great interest, and we recently struck upon the idea of producing our own version of the Divided States Project. We decided to send Peter Wharf and Scott Pohl out to talk with voters in the Lansing area, and they're here with what they found. Scott, how did the two of you go about finding the voters that we'll hear from?
Well, Mark, we wanted to devote this report to hearing from voters, not campaign staffers or volunteers, right, Peter? So, yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The challenge in that is finding voters to talk with on a somewhat random basis. Now, in talking this through, I mentioned the number of campaign signs I'd been seeing in the area where I live in the Diamonddale area. I've seen a few Hillary Clinton yard signs out that way, but there might be a few more Donald Trump signs in yards around me. Peter, you'd seen some Clinton signs where you live out in Meridian Township, right?
Like you, I've seen a mix throughout the township and elsewhere.
Yeah, and so you chose a neighbor, actually, to speak with, right?
I did. We're going to hear from Eric in a little while. We talk all the time, not typically politics, but it's that time of year, so right. The talk naturally turns that way. And that's how I got to Eric, just by being neighbors.
Well, to sum up, Mark, instead of randomly knocking on doors or standing on a street corner somewhere, we decided to approach folks who were making it clear which candidate they've decided to support. So I hit the road to visit some homes with Donald Trump yard signs, and I spoke with Jim DeWitt. Jim lives near Diamonddale. I asked him what he likes about the Republican nominee.
I don't have any really big reasons. It says that I like Trump's views on the military because I'm a former military. I got 24 years in, or I had 24 years in. And the way he sounds, he's going to do a lot more for the veterans, and I really appreciate that. Hillary, I like as a politician. I mean, she's done some good work there, but I think our country here now needs to help the veterans out.
What do you like about what he has said about veterans in the campaign?
Well, one of the things was about the VA hospitals, about helping them out, getting them going better, and just taking care of our vets, our war vets.
When you hear about the negatives that have come up about Trump during the campaign, do any of them disturb you or make you think twice about your support?
Well, not really. I mean, I think every man's got his opinion about certain things, you know, and Trump certainly has that. But I think as far as some of his comments, it probably wasn't the greatest, but I think he's still a man, and I think he's a good businessman. I think that'd be great for the country.
Have you watched the two debates, and have they had any impact on the way you feel?
I did not watch the debates. My wife's a pretty good Trump fan, so she watched it, and she really liked it, and she taped it, so I'll probably be watching it sometime, but I just take a lot of his views on, like I said, the veterans.
Some of the recent criticism about him has had to do with the way he treats women or what he has said about women in the past. Have you and your wife discussed that?
Not really, but, you know, I've thought they've been a little bit bad, but I think a lot of men think that way, you know. But nothing really, I don't think, personal. It's just the way men talk sometimes.
Were you always a Trump supporter since the time that he announced his campaign over a year ago?
Well, I had my doubts. I had my doubts about, you know, maybe some of his foreign policies with the trade and stuff. But like I say, he's a very good businessman, and I think he'll work that out.
Are you typically a Republican, would you say, or do you sometimes vote for Democrats?
I never have voted for a Republican.
Oh, is that right?
Yep, this would be the first time.
So did you consider voting for, supporting Hillary Clinton?
Well, I kind of like Bernie Sanders, too. But yes, I thought about it, but a couple things there that she did that I didn't like either, so I kind of changed.
What were those things?
I like some of her politics, you know, I do, but some of the stuff, I don't think that she's really for business in Michigan, you know. I think Trump is, so that's part of my reason too. You know, but mostly since I'm a 24-year vet, that's why I listened to Trump, and I kind of decided, you know, different.
When you say you decided, are you 100% certain that's what you're going to do?
I'm 100%, yes.
Jim DeWitt of Diamonddale, thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
That was WKAR's Scott Pohl speaking with a Donald Trump supporter here on Current State as we bring you our edition of Divided State, that series of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton supporters that you've been listening to throughout this election season on Morning Edition. We're speaking with supporters of the two candidates here in the greater Lansing area on Current State. I'm Peter Worf with Eric Stinson, who's a retired gardener for the city of Lansing. He lives in Okemos, Michigan. Mr. Stinson supports Hillary Clinton in the 2016 presidential election. He's a United States Navy veteran who served in Vietnam. Eric grew up during the 1950s and 60s, a time of great political and social change, which shaped his views and his family's.
My mother was an ardent supporter of civil rights, and which still makes me very proud. She was a single woman raising three children, and in her own way was a feminist, and in her own way, and she certainly was a Democrat. And I started watching the news when I was about 10 years old. And I watched lots of things happen. I remember John Kennedy being assassinated. I remember Martin Luther King being assassinated. I was in Vietnam, actually, as a hospital corpsman with the Navy when Martin Luther King was shot. And I mean, you can't watch all those things happen sequentially and not make certain conclusions. Now, right, wrong, or indifferent, I've always been a Democrat.
While Eric even goes so far as to call himself with a chuckle a yellow dog Democrat, he says he tries to remain open to differing points of view.
There are Republicans that I have admired in my life. My grandfather showed William Milliken around the township, Paradise Township near Traverse City. When Milliken was running for governor, my grandparents were people I looked up to. They were moderate Republicans. They were liberal Republicans. My grandmother, who was born in 1893, was pro-choice. I know Republicans. I have good friends who are Republicans, and I admire them. I don't quite understand their politics, I have to admit. But
Eric Stinson starts to move back to his lifelong Democratic roots as he addresses some of his objections to this year's GOP presidential candidate.
When Donald Trump declared that he was running, and then shortly thereafter criticized John McCain for being shot down by a Russian missile over North Vietnam, I sort of shook my head and I thought, he's really not running for president. This is not something somebody would say who's running for president. But as we've gone along, there have been other things of the same character that he has said. And part of my experience is that I joined the Navy when I was 17 years old. I went to Vietnam as a hospital corpsman, and I was in a Marine Corps line company. I was in a hospital setting also. I was in the 1st Medical Battalion when the Tet Offensive happened, and I have been impressed by John McCain in the past for his politics, not so much now, but I've never, ever thought of him as anything but a profoundly heroic person. But the next thing that happened was during the convention when the Gold Star parents spoke in front of the convention. And I have known Gold Star parents, and you take care of Gold Star parents. You treat them with the deepest respect. And it was clear to me that he had I don't think he knew what a Gold Star parent was, number one, and he had no sense whatsoever of what they had gone through.
While Stinson supports Hillary Clinton's candidacy, Eric characterizes one of his closest issues, discussed briefly in the most recent presidential debate, as something that's been minimized in this year's discussion.
Hillary Clinton mentioned climate change. I am astounded that this hasn't been more on the table during the entire process. This issue all by itself, I would hope someday, will be a major part of anybody's campaign. I look at this campaign, I blame both parties for not bringing it up. This is the one that is the freight train, and we're the ones that have our, we're bound to the track, and the train's coming.
Eric Stinson of Okemos and Jim DeWitt of Diamonddale, each supporters of the two different candidates, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, for this year's presidential election. It's part of Current State's Divided State series. As we spin off of that series, you've been listening to on Morning Edition during this election season. For Scott Pohl, I'm Peter Wharf for Current State.
And coming up on Current State, October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. For Neighbors in Action, we're going to hear from MSU Safe Place about the work they do to help victims of domestic violence and abuse. That's later this hour on Current State on WKAR. Halloween is a booming retail business in America. Every October, all sorts of seasonal stores rise up out of the proverbial pumpkin patch with an assortment of masks, costumes, and gothic horror decor. Sometimes just seeing the price tag at the cash register is enough to give you the spooks. Is there a less expensive alternative? Actually, yes. A homemade Halloween is hardly a new concept. An upcoming event in Lansing aims to help do-it-yourselfers learn the science of scare. Now in its third year, How to Halloween will be held this weekend at the Lansing Center. I spoke with Steve Sneed, the co-founder of How to Halloween, and his son Zach. They've turned Halloween into an annual engineering project. Steve says How to Halloween is a serious educational lesson all dressed up like a fun family outing.
The sinister goal of it, though, is that we are really trying to use Halloween as a way to educate kids and get them inspired in STEM. You know, STEM is science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. We also throw A in there for art as well. Get into the hands-on spirit of America, you know, the maker movement, and just really get into building cool stuff in their garages or their basements with their parents. just doing really neat stuff. So what we're trying to do with this event is kind of tap into that a bit. We have classes where people can learn how to make fake blood or gore using latex, or makeup, or even into making other devices.
Not surprisingly, your passion for Halloween started as a kid, but I understand it really took off for you as an adult when you started decorating your home for Halloween. Tell us about that.
That's correct. My family lived in Langsburg for 11 years, great community. We just happened to be on a busy road where it wasn't practical for kids to stop by and trick-or-treat. So when my son was 5 years old, we moved out into the Hazlitt community, and I said, why don't we go into the basement and create something cool for the kids at trick-or-treat? So we went down into the basement and built a Frankenstein monster that kids could try and shock to life. His skeleton would glow, his head would shake as if he was being shocked and what have you. And that really kind of set the hook for us. It became an opportunity for us each year to build something cool and get into new technologies and just bond over creating something fun. So that's really what the impetus for the event was.
And Steve, your son Zach is here with us here today. How many of these projects have you gotten involved with your dad creating?
Probably be about 11.
Okay.
I'm 16
that
now,
is a lot of projects.
Yeah.
What's the most memorable one? What's the one you're proudest of?
That's tough. I think we did Mutex Laboratories, which was set up this mutant laboratory in our garage where we had family friends come in and act as these failed science experiments, and people would have to come and defend against them.
Yeah.
And so that was fun to be a part of.
Yeah, good fun.
Using guns. Yeah. Our family and friends weren't too happy with us after doing that for a couple hours. But
yeah.
But hey, we had fun.
We're talking about How to Halloween, an annual event taking place this weekend at the Lansing Center. This is the third year for the event. My guests are Steve Sneed, the co-founder of How to Halloween, and his son, Zach. This is something you can't just think about when October rolls around. What does it take to plan this event every year?
We are planning next year's event already.
Yeah. Not surprised to hear that.
We are actually in partnership with the LEPFA folks, the people that run the Lansing Center, and they're using this as an outreach thing, really. So they're really trying to grow businesses like ours and reach out into the community and inspire them. So we are working with them right now, planning things out for next year. We've got our dates in place and everything. So
we wanted to illustrate the tinkerer motif of How to Halloween. We've got a clip that we'd like to play right now. This is from your interview last year with our producer, Scott Pohl. The two of you are standing in your garage, just as you remember, and you're demonstrating a game that you and your partner, Jerry, invented called Green Invaders from the Red Planet. This is an interactive game you developed to give the trick-or-treaters a little fun thing to do when they're out collecting candy. Let's listen.
Each gun has its own unique identifier, so I know who's shooting what alien. The way that works is we have an air compressor. It uses air to move targets up and down. It routes into the circuit board that I built with some engineering friends of mine. And what it allows me to do is use my computer to direct air out certain channels. So if I, on my computer, I say, send air to piston number one. Piston number one will extend and it will pop the target up and the kids will shoot at it.
Cool.
Sounds pretty memorable.
That was fun.
Zach, what are you concocting for this Halloween?
Well, that's always a secret.
Okay. Okay. I understand.
That is part of the mystique. There's people bunging us already, and we kind of unveil it the day of the event.
Got it. What are some of the new exhibits, though, this year at the Lansing Center?
We try to emphasize a lot of different things. We brag about how we have 50 different family-friendly activities for kids and families to do. This year, we have a bunch of Ghostbusters there who like to get up in costumes and build proton packs, and they've made the Ecto-1 Ghostbuster Mobile, if that's what it's called. We have a bunch of Star Wars reenactors showing off their costumes. This year, we're also starting to emphasize a lot of the hands-on and STEM type stuff, too. We have something called the STEMetary, where we have the MSU College of Engineering showing up with a bunch of robots that the kids can play with. We have a bunch of 3D printers, a bunch of other hands-on thing. Zach, why don't you tell me a bit about the toy hack?
Yeah. If you've ever seen Toy Story, then you you know Sid, who pulls apart toys and puts them together in these grotesque type of mannequins. And so we have a group here who's going to do that this year. And we can just pull apart a bunch of weird toys and put them together in these godless creations. And and it's pretty great.
Yeah, Sid was my favorite character in Toy Story.
And yeah.
This is always a popular thing at our event, too.
Got it. I'd like to switch gears just a little bit here, though, while we're talking about games. Since the last time we had you on Current State, you and Zach have actually made history. It happened earlier this year in Sandusky, Ohio. Tell us what happened.
What we did is every year we speak at a conference called CodeMash, and it is a family-friendly tech conference that has a lot of people in it. What we did was we had a bunch of the attendees come in, and we had them play help us set the record for the most people playing one single game of Pong. So if you remember Pong, that's a game from 1972, I think, Zach, is that right?
Yeah.
Where it's just a version of table tennis. So a paddle will go up, a ball will go by. Well, what we did was we got it so that we actually had 379 people playing one game. And what we did is we handed out laser pointers, and we'd have them all point their laser pointer on the screen where they wanted the paddle to go. So if you can imagine that, so the paddle goes up on the side in order to catch the ball.
Right.
Well, they're basically using their laser pointers to vote where they all want their paddle to go. It's hard. It is hard to describe over the radio, but it really turned into this really cool mass thing where actually one of the people are helping us out said this. He's actually been to the World Cup, you know, like a World Cup soccer game. And it felt very much like that because half the crowd was on one team and they were yelling, go, 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 Team Red. And the other team was yelling.
People got into it.
Oh, it was insane. It was very cool. So.
But I understand Guinness did not count all of your participants. What happened?
What happened there, this is just kind of a little behind the scenes, what happens with Guinness is you can pay $8,000 to have them come out and certify you and give you a certificate right there. We didn't have that kind of money. So what you do instead is you go through you have a bunch of documentation and volunteers, and you have to point a camera at the door in order to count all the people that are coming in. Well, our camera died after 251 people. Mm. So we had 379 people actually do it, but we only got credit for 251.
Zach, do you expect you'll pursue something in the STEM field once you're out of school and in the working world?
I think either as a career or a hobby, I think it'll definitely stick with me.
Mm. And will you offer a group Pong again this weekend?
We are going to have that there, yeah. We're not going to be able to set any world record, I think, but we are going to have it there, and people are going to, we could have two people playing or we could have 500 people playing. That's kind of a cool thing.
It's Steve Sneed's favorite time of year. Steve's the co-founder of How to Halloween. The third annual event takes place this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, from 11 till 5 at the Lansing Center in downtown Lansing. We've been joined by Steve's son, Zach, who's also a participant. It's all an homage to the do-it-yourself phenomenon that's growing across the country. Steve, Zach, thank you for being here. Best of luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Come on down.
And coming up on Current State, Dominic Davis spent years in the Lansing area performing with roots band Steppin' In It. Now in Nashville, Davis talks about his appearance this Saturday evening with Jack White on the relaunch of Public Radio's A Prairie Home Companion.
You could almost say half of all of his records from the beginning have been acoustic.
Of course, you'll be able to hear that here on WKAR. Dominic Davis talking about his music and his working relationship with Jack White and lots more later this hour on Current State. Well, we have another rock star who's a little bit more like royalty, more so than he was. British rocker Rod Stewart, knighted yesterday by Prince William. Sir Rod was shown in photos sporting his new medal, identifying him as a member of the Order of the British Empire, an OBE. It's Current State here on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. In the United States, 1 in 4 women, 1 in 7 men will experience severe physical violence by an intimate partner in their lifetime. That's according to the Centers for Disease Control. As October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, we're going to explore what some local organizations are doing to help victims. Joining us today, Erica Schmidt-Deal, a licensed master social worker with MSU Safe Place and an advocacy coordinator with CARE, which stands for Capital Area Response Effort. Erica, welcome to Current State.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us, Merkeb Johannes. Merkeb is a domestic violence survivor and a volunteer at CARE. Welcome, Merkeb.
Thank you.
Erica, explain the relationship here between MSU Safe Place, which a lot of people know about, and CARE.
Yes. So in 2000, we received a Department of Justice grant, and my position was written so that the advocate at the time, before I came on board in 2001, could be an advocate for both MSU Safe Place clients, MSU students, staff, faculty, and their partners, and then also work in the Greater Lansing community to provide advocacy and help identify any MSU individuals who needed services and may call 911 but may not necessarily call MSU Safe Place, either out of fear, embarrassment, or maybe not knowing that we exist. So it was really a partnership to reach out to more survivors in the community.
Well, clarify for us, does MSU Safe Place only serve MSU students or people in the MSU community?
No, we don't. Our primary focus is MSU students, staff, faculty, and their partners. However, we do serve the Greater Lansing community as well.
Merkeb, you volunteer with CARE and you yourself are a survivor of domestic violence. How much does your personal experience contribute to your desire to volunteer?
I think it's the key reason I do volunteer. It's a way of me giving back to people that have been and that are in my situation, as well as in a slightly selfish way, a way to continue healing in my own process. Mm.
So it does sharing time with other survivors aids in your own recovery.
It sure does. I think sharing my story and experiences with others is a way to remind me that I've come a long way and is a way to remind me that there are resources for the moments that I do have difficulties. Mm-hmm.
Tell us what you do as a volunteer.
Well, my primary responsibility as a volunteer is to provide information and resources. I like to tell people that I'm not available or there for victims to make their choices or to judge the situation. Resources are only as good as you use them. So I find that a lot of people are not aware, as Erica touched on, or maybe are embarrassed. But to say, hey, you know what? I'm a real person. I've been through this. Here's some information. Use it as you choose. Mm.
Erica, talk to us about the services MSU Safe Place provides, the basic services.
Sure. So we are the first and only shelter on a college campus in the nation, but shelter is only one thing that we provide. We have non-residential services as well, so people don't have to stay in our shelter to get support. We also have a support group and individual counseling, and we do advocacy services, and I'm one of the 2 advocates on staff, which basically means that I help people get whatever it is that they need. Again, like Merkeb said, we're not here to tell people what to do or make decisions for them, but we can provide them with information, rights, options, and should they choose to take advantage of what we have to offer, if whatever they identify they need, that's what we're here to help them with. It could be a divorce attorney, it could be an immigration attorney. We have a large international population here at MSU and in the Greater Lansing community. So perhaps the abuser is using the survivor's immigration status against them. We can go to court with people, help them get a personal protection order, do safety planning. There's really a variety of things that we can help people with.
I'm speaking with Erica Schmidt-Deal, a social worker with MSU Safe Place and an advocacy coordinator with CARE, and with Merkeb Johannes, a domestic violence survivor and a CARE volunteer. Merkeb, could you tell us a little bit of your own story? What was the breaking point for you here in your domestic violence?
I think my biggest breaking, I say biggest breaking points because I think I had several breaking points, but the one that sort of shook me into realization was in that moment, I was truly, truly, and genuinely fearful for my life. I really believed that in that moment, my abuser would kill me. And this happened in front of my son at the time, who was 3 years old. So I think he gave me the power to sort of say, I deserve more. I deserve the opportunity to be a mom. I deserve the opportunity to be happy. And my son did not deserve to potentially be left in the hands of this abuser. So in that moment, I made a difficult call. It was not easy, despite the circumstances.
Where did you go?
I called 911. I called 911 and I ran out of my home and I left my son behind because I felt it was that important and that situation was that critical. I was very fortunate that a police officer who simply said, "How can I help you?" and "I believe you," was the man who responded to my call. And from there, it was a whole community, a whole network of people who helped me through processes like Erica mentioned, through a personal protective order until the end time through my divorce. And now through this healing process.
Was this in Michigan? Was this in the Lansing?
A portion of my relationship was in was in Lansing, yeah.
You had the wherewithal to seek help and to get help, but not all victims. Some victims go through even probably worse than you did and still do not seek help. Why don't victims seek help more often or just leave the abusive situations that they're in?
You know, that's a tough question. A lot of people say, hey, it's so easy, just walk away. He's hurting you or she's hurting you. I urge everyone to sort of read a little bit and educate yourself a little bit about domestic violence. It's a cycle. It's a cycle of power and abuse. And in hindsight, I see that. But in that moment, it's very difficult because it's not always all bad. You know, there are moments in your relationship that are good. Nobody wants to fail in their relationship. So I think there's that passion to sort of fix everything on my end. I can't speak on behalf of every victim, but on my end, it's that desire to fix a relationship, that desire to hold on to what was good in hopes that, hey, I can change this. I think there was the constant blaming of things, not the person, but the things. It's because we're having money issues. It's because he drank too much. It's because, everybody's struggling with, you know, the material things, or he was angry, or I pushed his buttons.
Any number of things
yeah, for anybody. Yeah. And in hindsight, I realized it's not the things, the individual, whether we were in a good part of our marriage or a not so great part of our marriage, was still abusive.
Let me ask you this. Was the man who threatened you the father of your son?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's got to complicate things.
Absolutely.
Even much, much, much more. Erica, as you've advocated for victims, you must have observed some of the very same obstacles that you're hearing about.
Absolutely. Here. And Merkeb was so lucky to have a police officer that was supportive of her. And we have many good police officers in the Lansing area that respond appropriately to domestic violence situations. But unfortunately, we still have some individuals that are not responding appropriately in law enforcement, in the courts, in counseling, where the therapist believes that it's a couple's counseling problem and that both individuals have problems in the relationship they need to work on, rather than understanding that the problem is an imbalance of power and that one person needs to stop being abusive. It's not within the victim's control to stop the abuse. So we have a long way to go to educate our communities about domestic violence and how to appropriately respond. If systems responded better, more survivors would come forward, more survivors would leave their abusive situations.
Let's talk about PPOs, personal protective orders. Mercab, I know you got one. Was that a turning point in getting past this?
Absolutely. My PPO to me served as my security, as knowing that I now have control over this situation. I am able to say, hey, law enforcement, this man should not be near me. Hey, law enforcement, my son needs protection, which prior to the PPO, I felt, well, he's our son, so I have to share him, or I'm his wife, so he has certain rights. And I learned a lot through that process. So yes, absolutely, I think it was fundamental for me.
And this is one of the tools in your toolbox at MSU Safeplace is the PPO.
Absolutely.
Is that the same thing as a restraining order? I mean, you hear restraining
order.
It's the same thing.
Yeah. Okay. In Michigan, we call them PPOs or personal protection orders.
What can a friend or a loved one do when they know someone is in an abusive situation?
Believe them, support them. A lot of times, friends and family members can't believe that an abusive person could be abusive. They only see the good side. Many abusers are very charming, very likable, and they save their abuse for behind closed doors.
Yeah.
So it can be very hard for family members and friends to believe that the abuser would act that way. But if somebody's coming to you and saying that they've been abused, believe them. They're probably not making it up. Support them. You don't have to solve their problems for them. There are professionals in the community that can support that victim or that survivor. But point them in the right direction would be my words of advice.
We want to thank both of our guests. I know you have an event coming up on the 21st involving Safe Place in just as briefly as you can.
Sure.
Erica, tell us about that.
Sure. So we have a candlelight vigil happening at the Broad Art Museum on campus, 6:30 p.m. on October 21st. That's a Friday. We're hosting that candlelight vigil in conjunction with CARE, EVE, Siren, Eaton Shelter, Lansing Police Department, and the Women's Center of Greater Lansing. So please come out and show your support for survivors of domestic violence.
I've been speaking with Erica Schmidt-Diehl, a licensed master social worker with MSU Safe Place and an advocacy coordinator with CARE. Also, Mercab Johannes, a domestic violence survivor and a CARE member. Mercab, thank you for sharing your story with us.
Thanks for having me.
Very much, and good luck to both of you.
Thank you.
Current State is looking for more nominations for our Neighbors in Action feature. Please help us out. Email us your suggestions to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line, please, or tweet us at KAR Current State. Please tell us a little bit about why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. Well, after being defined for about 40 years by its legendary host, Garrison Keillor, the next iteration of A Prairie Home Companion debuts this Saturday night. Mandolinist Chris Thiele replaces Keillor as the host of the program, which airs at 6 p.m. here on 90.5 FM. A couple of Michigan natives, one with close ties to Lansing, will be performing in the show. Dominic John Davis was the bass player for the acclaimed Lansing-based roots band Steppin' In It. Today, from his base in Nashville, Davis plays bass with Detroit native Jack White and in many other projects. Their latest project is Jack White Acoustic Recordings. Yesterday, Dominic Davis joined me by phone. Ahead of Saturday night's Prairie Home Companion performance in St. Paul, I asked him what it's like knowing he's helped launch the next iteration of the renowned program.
Well, it means a lot to me just because I've listened to the show for so long. You know, I've always was one foot in the folk world. And so I was a huge fan of Greg Brown for a long time, and he was a resident songwriter and musical guest there all the time. And my wife's parents, you know, she talks about them waltzing in the kitchen when she was really little to A Prairie Home. You know?
Yeah.
So it means a lot. And knowing Chris is taking it over and launching it anew, it feels really good to just kind of help the transition. So
you're on a first-name basis with Chris Thiele, the new host?
Yeah, well, we've done a few shows with him. I think he's closer with Jack than with us. But we did one of those Coen brother movies, Inside Llewelyn Davis.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, we did a, you know, for every one of those movies, they have a concert that T-Bone Burnett hosts. And so we did one with actually Lake Street Dive, and Chris and the Punch Brothers were there and a whole bunch of people. And so that was sort of our first encounter with them. So, which is interesting, because Lake Street Dive is going to be the other musical guest.
Yes, yes, they are, this Saturday night.
Yeah. So it's interesting, though, knowing the show so well and not knowing what to expect, because I'm pretty sure a lot of the bits are not going to be continuing anymore, because they're kind of impossible to do without Garrison.
I know Jack's probably best known for rock, but he's also really intense about folk and acoustic music. In a way, he's a perfect fit for Prairie Home Companion.
Yeah, that's one thing people don't realize. Like, this album, this acoustic compilation, it's got acoustic songs from all of his records. I mean, you could almost say half of all of his records from the beginning have been acoustic. And I, you know, we grew up together, so I know sort of what we were raised on. There was a lot of classic rock and things, but there was also a lot of folk music, a lot of Canadian folk, and just, you know, anybody that loves Bob Dylan as much as we do, you can't help but kind of dig back and...
Describe the music you've been making most recently with Jack, and generally talk to us about what it's like to work with him.
Well, we finished a tour in 2015, and Jack announced he was going to take a long break from touring. And then we launched an acoustic tour where we were going to play the five remaining states he'd never played. But we didn't tell anybody what those were. And so, and we announced the day of, and it was Alaska and Idaho, and, you know, all these kind of middle-of-nowhere places.
Yeah.
But that tour was an acoustic band with just four band members and four ribbon mics. So completely acoustic, nobody even plugging into anything, and no stage monitors, just like, you know, the way Hank Williams would have done it in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of pre-PA sound system, almost. And so this is the band that will be on that, on Prairie Home. So. Mm. And most recently, we've done records with, we did a single with Dwight Yoakam that came out not too long ago, and he's real interesting to work with. It's just very kind of last minute and letting things happen. And
let's listen to a bit of music from Jack White with our guest Dominic Davis on bass. This is called City Lights.
Jack works very last minute, so with City Lights, he knew he was making an acoustic compilation, and I think the day of called and said, I think this song needs something, you know. And so I think it was maybe 2 hours after I got the call to play on it, I'm playing on it, and that's kind of how things go, you know.
Pretty like, spontaneous.
Yeah, but in the same token, when we were teenagers, it was like the exact same thing. I've got a tape recorder, come over and play on a song, you know, so... 20 years later, not much has really changed.
Now, you and Joshua, and Steppin' in it, tore it up at the Green Door in Lansing and many other venues over the years. Since moving to Nashville, Dominic, how often are you gigging with Josh?
Pretty often. You know, since he did his whole venture onto The Voice and all that, it was really fortunate for him in a lot of ways, but it's fortunate for me because it suddenly made coming back and playing shows with him and all the guys possible. So we're doing the show in Charlotte on Friday, and then the two weekends from now we're playing the Arc in Ann Arbor, the 21st and 22nd.
That's right.
So it's really great. It's really kind of cemented, you know, we moved here, and I didn't know if I'd spend much time back in Michigan, and I've been back there quite a bit. We recorded his new album recently at Glenn Brown Studio in East Lansing, so it feels really good to be back there so often.
Let's listen to a little bit of you and Joshua here. This is Always Going to Be There.
Yes, some doors close when the clock turns five. You can wake me up in the middle of the night. You won't need cash or credit when the vent checks do. My window's always open and I'm always gonna be here for you.
Your wife, Rachel, will also be on stage with you and Joshua at the Arc on these October 21st and 22nd shows. Describe her music for us.
Well, she grew up in a family folk band playing with her parents, playing clawhammer banjo and ukulele and guitars and things. So she came from that folk tradition with the Wheatland Music Festival in Hiawatha up in the UP. And actually, she was born in Lansing, so her folks were 10-pound fiddle members and went to all the contra dances and all that, you know, real sort of folk revivalists.
There are a slew of other musical projects that you're involved with. Let's talk about one of them, at least. You and Jack are collaborating on a project for PBS, as it turns out, with Robert Redford and T-Bone Burnett. What's that about?
Something called American Epic, where it's kind of a long story, but in the 20s, before electricity, the record industry was buying and selling records for people to play on these Victrolas, these wind-up record players. But with the advent of electricity came the advent of radio. Then suddenly wealthy people were no longer buying records because they had radios. So in the mid-20s, for the first time ever, record companies sent lathes, these portable lathes, down through the South to record basically poor people's music for poor people to consume. So for the first time ever, Mississippi John Hurt and, you know, Bessie Smith and Jimmy Rogers and all these folks that were common folks playing common folks music, it sort of changed the entire musical landscape, because blues has influenced everything since and maybe wouldn't have been recorded and sold if it wasn't for radio to come along. So Jack got one of those lathes. It's an old Scully lathe. It's totally mechanical. You wind up this, like, coffee can of cement. It's very heavy, and it drives the turntable, and you cut right into it. And you have this one microphone. The lathe itself doesn't take electricity, but the microphone does. And you just kind of position yourself around, you know, like you heard tales of Robert Johnson in the hotel room, or you know, Jimmy Rogers in Bristol. This is that machine.
Well, I'm flashing on that moment in the movie Jack was in, It Might Get Loud, where he basically creates a guitar on the porch of his farmhouse.
Exactly.
It was a really primitive kind of thing, but it's perfect Jack White, really, in a way.
Yeah, so they got 30 modern artists, from hip-hop to, you know, Nas was on there, Willie Nelson and Merle, the Alabama Shakes played, Elton John, you know, all these folks came and recorded on this primitive machine. So you really have to cut a record and listen to it. And, oh, the vocals are too loud, take a step back. Cut another record. The bass is too quiet, take a step forward.
Wow.
You know, after about 8 of those, then you got the mix right. And it was really incredible. And we served as the house band. A lot of folks played on their own. But getting to play with Willie and getting to play with Taj Mahal and all these folks, you know, and all of them, this isn't lost on them, you know. Taj Mahal is such a huge Charlie Patton fan. And Charlie recorded on a machine just like this. So he really, you know, it's mind-blowing for anyone involved. So,
do you know when the program is going to make it to TV?
Yeah, they've pushed it a few times, so I think they're saying spring now. They did say October. It was going to be this month, but I'm pretty sure it's being pushed again. They've been touring, doing film festival screenings of it.
One last question before we let you go. I've never heard how Steppin' in It got its name. How did that happen?
I think we inherited the name from a earlier incarnation of the band. But Steppin' in It was a Herbie Hancock song off an album of his called Manchild. So we sort of inherited the name from an earlier incarnation of the band. So, and, you know, some of us maybe liked it or didn't like it over the years.
Dominic Davis has been our guest. He's the bass player for Jack White and many, many others. We've been speaking with him from Nashville right ahead of a couple of big performances. Saturday night, he joins Jack White on the next iteration, the next chapter of A Prairie Home Companion with host Chris Thiele. That can be heard, of course, here on 90.5 WKAR. And you can see Dominic and Joshua Davis at the Charlotte Performing Arts Center this Friday night ahead of the Prairie Home Companion appearance, and at the Arc in Ann Arbor, October 21st and 22nd, along with Dominic's wife, Rachel. Dominic Davis, great talking to you. Good luck.
Thank you, Mark. Goodbye, Michigan.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the United States and in Michigan. What are the signs someone is thinking about committing suicide? How can we prevent it? Current State's Brooke Allen talks about the signs we should watch for, and we'll hear one woman's intimate story of her struggle with depression and personal loss. Plus, we'll take a tango with maestro Jorge Perotti to learn more about Opera Grand Rapids' upcoming production of Maria de Buenos Aires. Current State's Jamie Paisley has a preview. A reminder that your financial support of WKAR makes it possible to do Current State 7 days a week on WKAR. Our fall donor campaign is coming to radio on Friday. Between now and then, you can visit WKAR.org and make your gift. You'll automatically be entered to win a one-night stay and play courtesy of Fire Keepers Hotel and Casino in Battle Creek. Thank you very much for your financial support. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Kevin Lavery directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and Drew Hill. The Current State podcast is your informative, insightful, and indispensable connection with what's happening around mid-Michigan and beyond, from politics to education, environmental news to healthcare. It's all there, the Current State podcast, anywhere, anytime at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mark Bayshore. See you tomorrow on Current State.